So this will be Rabbi Cardozo's last session of the day. We thank him once again for being with us. And those of you who've been here for his previous sessions know that he is an unafraid thinker, let's put it that way, who's able to speak his mind intelligently, thoughtfully, forcefully, and creatively. So please welcome Rabbi Cardozo.
Can I ask this part to come this way that I don't have to move around all the time? It's speaking very hard. So just come on this side. I want to discuss something with you which is a very difficult and complicated issue. And I want to do it in a way which you probably have never heard before, and try to respond to some of the great issues which Jewish philosophy, secular philosophy throughout the years have always been engaged in. All what I'm going to say now, first of all, I am the only one responsible for this. Not Torah emotion, not the rabbis, not the professors, just myself. So don't hold them responsible or hold it against them. Secondly, what I have to say is still standing in scarf holdings. It is just being built. I hope one day to publish all this in a large essay, but it is something which is involving. It needs more work, but I already would like to somehow make you part of this discussion. And I hope that when you go home afterwards, you will not be able to sleep tonight. I want to discuss an issue which is keeping all of us busy and all of us alive, or better, not asleep, but awake. We have the old problem of what we call in Hebrew tzadik v'ralo v'rasha v'toflo. The problem of how it is that the world is such an unjustified, such a difficult world where so many things happen which are not fair on many different levels. As I told you before, those who were with my first Hartza'ah, this lecture is officially called God is not righteous and the Torah is not moral. And I mean exactly what I say. But at the same time, I believe that what I'm going to say about these two statements and what I have in mind with that definitely, totally fits within the Jewish tradition. And also, I don't like these words, but I believe that they even could fit into the Orthodox Jewish tradition, whatever that means, which I'm not at all clear about. My points are these. God is a disappointment, and the Torah is a disappointment. But God exists, and the Torah is divine. It is, as we say in Hebrew, min hashamayim. It is from heaven. I take these words very serious. I believe that these are the words of God, but they are a disappointment. And the way how God deals with this world and what God is all about is also a disappointment, but as far as I'm concerned, he definitely exists. What that again means, I already touched on that this morning a little bit, Spinoza, pantheism, all these different issues. It's all very vague and not very clear, but ultimately we have to say there is some kind of being, for the lack of a better word, which no doubt makes us to say that he does exist And so I say the same about the Torah. I do not buy into Bible critique, although I have many, many years studied it. I do not see any reason why I should change my mind about this. I still believe this word to be the word of God. What that exactly means is again another issue. So these are the two points of departure. God is a disappointment and the Torah is a disappointment. But both are true. Now let me first of all go into some specifics. Let me start with the following. When I say that the Torah is a disappointment, then I mean to say by that, there are certain laws in the Torah which are morally problematic. And I think you all know that. There are laws there which don't run well with us, where we feel that something is being done to certain people which should not actually exist. I give you one or two examples, you know them. Take, for example, the law concerning the mamzer, which we normally translate in English with bastard, which is not a very good translation. A mamzer is a child which is born from two Jewish parents, where the mother is actually married to another Jewish man. And she has relations with another Jewish man, she gets pregnant, and out of that, a child is being born. That child has a status in the halacha of mamzer. What does this mean on a practical basis? Very disturbing, but also very interesting. And that is that while the child is generally considered to be a full member of the Jewish community, can even become a rabbi, the only main thing where he is incredibly, or she is incredibly limited, is in the case of marriage. A mamzer can nearly not marry with anybody. Can definitely not marry with any person just like that in the Jewish community. The only person he or she can marry is another mamzer. And then, strangely enough and disturbingly enough, if these get children, they are again mamzerim. And they have the problem again. The other thing is that a mamzer can marry a gioret, which is also a very strange thing, somebody who was converted into the Jewish tradition, but again, the child is a mamzer. There are one or two other cases where they can marry, but they are no longer applicable today. But let's be quite honest and straight about this. This seems to be, to say the least, totally unfair. After all, here is a child which pays the price for a transgression of the parents. If anybody should get actually punished, it are the parents. By the way, they are. But still, at the same time, the child is punished without having anything to do with this whole issue. But this is one of the 13 commandments in the Torah. It is there. And I don't think we are able just to say, because we don't like it, we can just not do away with it. And I will tell you later why that is the case. But I will be the first one to say that it is completely and totally unfair. The Torah does not live up to my moral standards I would like it to apply. Another case which you also know is the aguna problem. A woman who is married and her husband runs away, or we don't know where he is, he may be alive, he may be dead, and we can't prove one or the other, she becomes a changed woman, aguna, which means, as long as we have no absolute proof that her husband is dead, she cannot marry anybody else at no time. Till, or it is proven that he's dead, or he gave her a get. He gave her a bill of divorce in according to Jewish law. These are the only two cases where she can get remarried again. I'm sure that in Toronto, but definitely in Israel, there are quite a few cases like that where women are walking around and cannot get married because of this very reason. Now, it is also true that there were rabbis over the years, and to my great regret, today the rabbis are no longer prepared to use these different halachic methods to get them out of this problem. I don't want to go into this now, but the rabbinate today doesn't have any courage, and therefore it doesn't dare to do anything, but it could probably do, but that is again a whole topic on its own. But whatever it is, the problem is there. the Mamsa problem, the Aguna problem. In the olden days, there were some other problems, which we don't want to go into now, because I just want to give an overview of all this. But one more thing I would like to say, and that is the general situation of this, the discrimination of women in Jewish law. You can argue left and right, and use the best arguments to justify that. And it is definitely true that Jewish women are much better off in the Jewish tradition than they're probably anywhere else. They're better protected, and they're better looked after. If you look what the rabbis did for the women in the past, look in the Talmud, it is really remarkable what enormous risks they were prepared to take, even sometimes seemingly violating the original laws of the Torah when they felt there was a need for that and they felt there was a justification for that. But it is still true that the male plays a major role and more of a role within that society, in the Torah society, than the female does. That as such stays unfair. A woman cannot give a get to her husband. You can perhaps press and force a man to give a divorce to his wife, a get, and perhaps we don't use that enough today. But on the end of the day, it is not an equal situation. Only a man can divorce his wife. We can perhaps divorce him to divorce his wife. But if she writes a get to her husband, it's like a piece of paper. It has absolutely no halachic validity. It doesn't work. We can't get around this. So there is a problem in that respect as well. And what it obviously does, especially today in our modern world, is it brings the whole of the Jewish tradition into great disrepute. If Jewish tradition cannot handle these problems and find a fair answer to these issues, we have a problem. And that's what's going on today. Now, I'm quite well aware that in non-Orthodox circles, they would like and have already changed some of these rules because they are unfair. In the Reform community, they did away with the Mamzer law, more or less altogether. The question about divorce depends on what Reform community, or for that reason in the conservative movement, where it is definitely treated in a different way. And I say this only with the greatest amount of respect, and I very well understand from where they are coming. Within the Orthodox world, there is a limitation here, because at the end of the day, there are some laws there which we believe are divine. We feel that they are unfair, but they are still God-given, and what can we do about it? Now, once more, be aware of this. The rabbis have done everything and anything, just look into our tradition, to try to solve these problems. And they really went to the edge. And they really did things which I don't think any other kind of religious personality would even dare to do by, I would nearly say, challenging these laws. And saying, well, perhaps we should indeed do away with it, but do that in a specific way so that halachically it is possible to do that. And as I said before, one of the big promises today is there are many solutions to many of these problems, which the rabbis don't make use of. On the other side, it is true that there are certain cases where there is just no way to solve them. And we are standing with our back against the wall, and however much we would like to do this thing, within Orthodox halacha, there is no opportunity to do this. I cannot do anything else but to recognize that possibility. But does that mean to say that therefore we should just say, it cannot be, it shouldn't be? That's a completely different question. If you buy into the fact that the Torah is not min hashamayim, not from heaven, then you have obviously the option to say, okay, we will do away with whatever we want to do away with. But within a tradition as we know it, we cannot so easily do that. And if you look around today, by the way, there's enormous literature on there written by some very important people who have been writing on this topic, especially about feminism. Professor Tamar Ross, I don't know if you heard that name, she's a very important person in this field, a very good friend of mine. Eliezer Berkowitz, Dr. Chazoni is at the moment speaking about them, has been writing about all these issues. There are some remarkable pieces of work, which badly enough the rabbinate in Israel is not prepared to accept, also no doubt in many ways they have something of a solution. But once more, it's not always a solution, in every specific case. We should also make another point, and that is that it is strange that these laws exist. Why? Because they don't fit in the rest of the Torah. The Torah is constantly asking for justice. We constantly say that the children should not pay for the avirot, for the transgressions of their parents. That's a general rule. And then suddenly there is an exception, where they do seem to be that case. And where is this? Why is that? Very often, I would even dare to say like this, that people who criticize Jewish law today actually do that in the name of Jewish tradition. Because they use all the arguments of the Jewish tradition to undo one particular part of the Jewish tradition which doesn't fit into the general Weltanschauung, the general outlook of life, which the halakha normally happens to reveal. Which is there very strange. Why are these laws there when they don't go along with the rest of the Torah? They contradict the Torah, basically. So how is it that they are there in the first place? I want to show you this in the most unusual way, and I hope you're able to follow me, and I will try to be as clear as I can, by also discussing another thing. Here there are problems concerning the justice of the Torah itself, the Bible, as it is understood by the rabbis. But we have also problems with God himself. True, we see God as the author of the Torah, but there are some other things which God does, about which I would say that he doesn't seem to be so righteous as we would like him to be. Actually, we just had one in America. The hurricane which took place over there. It's very hard to start justifying this on a religious level by saying that God did this for this or that particular reason. 5 million people are still without electricity, I understood today. And loads of people are being their lives have been destroyed. And this is, in accordance to Jewish belief, the hand of God. In Israel, there is already this joke going around why God did not bring this hurricane to the Iranis instead of to the Americans. We don't wish it on anybody. But earthquakes, terrible also natural disasters, which have taken place, in which man has no hand whatsoever. Not like the Holocaust, which man created. Here we have things which in nature take place, which we nearly can't stop at all, and we believe that this is the hand of God. Now take both these matters into account, as well what is going on in the Torah. Certain things are morally highly problematic, and at the same time, the deeds of God, as we see it around us all the time, and not, by the way, only in hurricanes and in terrible earthquakes, but people are getting ill, children getting ill, babies dying. There are lots of issues there where we all have our questions about the divine and how it works with what we believe God is all about. I'm going to show you, to read to you, a Talmudic statement, which I think deals with this problem. And I have to ask you again to be awake and to go come with me, because this is hard stuff. There is in the Talmud a discussion between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, the two great Mishnaic schools, which speak about the question of why human beings actually exist, and if it is fair that they exist. Let me read you the Talmud and I'll translate it for you. It's a remarkable piece of Talmud. You can only find something like that in the Talmud. You won't find it anywhere else in the world. It says like this, Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught, Shtei shanim u'mechetze, 2.5 years, Nichleku Beit Shammai u'Beit Hillel, there was a difference of opinion between the great sages, the great houses of the sages of these days, in the days of the Mishnah, a long time ago, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. What did they disagree about? Halalu omrim, those, one school said, Noach lo le Adam shelo nifra yotem eshenifra. It would have been better for man not to be created than to be created. It would have better been if there would not have been a world no universe, no human beings, nothing at all, just God. That would have been better. That's one opinion. Comes the second opinion, the Halalu Omrim, and the others are saying, Noach lole Adam shenifra yote mishelo nifra. And the other opinion is, no, it is better for man to be created than not to be created. So one school says it is better for man not to be created, and the other school says it is better for man that he is created. That is what they discuss. 2.5 years they're busy discussing this. So what is the answer? Who is right? Says the Talmud, most surprising, strange thing. Nimnu v'damru. They took a vote about this. And they were looking for the majority. Was the majority saying it is better for man to be created, or was the majority saying it is better for man not to be created? What happened? They took a vote. Democracy, we would say. And what was the conclusion? The conclusion was that the majority sitting in the classroom or in this room where this debate took place, that Noach lo le'adam shelo nifra. It was better for man that he would not have been created. That's the final answer. Ask the Talmud the obvious question. Achshak shenifra. But since man, after all, has been created, what shall we do? Says the Talmud, typically the Talmud, yefashfesh b'ma'asav. He should look into his deeds. He should behave carefully and well and be a righteous person. That is the end conclusion. Better that man was not being created. And as we say in Yiddish, never he was created. But now that never he is created, what shall he do with the time that he spends in this world? Let him look after his deeds and let him be as righteous as he can be. Now, when I for the first time saw this particular Talmudic statement, I must tell you, I nearly fell from my chair. What kind of argument is this? What's going on there? Let me tell you one thing. I understand that when you have halachic legal problems, you can decide them in according to a majority vote. On the end of your day, you have to know yes or no. And that's what we do. But this is not a halachic issue. This is a philosophical issue. And let me tell you one thing. I'm in the world of philosophy. The majority vote in a philosophy case, that means when most people say this is the truth in philosophy, you can be sure that that is not true. Most people are not philosophers. They can't think in philosophical terms. If you start to decide philosophical issues on the basis of who believes what, you are destroying philosophy from beginning till very end. The truth about philosophy is that there are the minorities who are right. The majorities have no clue what they're speaking about. And here you're going to decide on a matter concerning a philosophical problem, not a halachic problem, not a practical problem. A philosophical problem, and then you, by a vote of majority, you're going to decide on that? Since when is a majority here at all at stake? What has it to do with that? It may be that one philosopher is right and all the others were wrong. No, in this case, it is decided for in the same way as we decide halachic issues, by way of a majority vote. Very strange. And you wonder what they are trying to say over here. By the way, obviously there's another problem. If it would have been better, now hear well, if it would have been better for man not to be created, so why then did God create us? If that is the better thing, then God should have done the better thing. Because after all, he is such a good God. And if he would really have been a good God, then he would have said, you know what, it's not worthwhile creating them. It creates a lot of trouble, a lot of problems. They will have pain, they'll have war, they have earthquakes, they have hurricanes and things like that. Let's leave the whole thing for what it was. I will stay where I am, nothing being created at all, and everything would be nicely under control, and nobody would suffer. So what are they doing over here? Are they saying something like this? God, you should not have created this world. And you made a big mistake in creating it, and we are paying the price for it. Like the Mamzer is paying the price. Like the Agunah is paying the price. And so many other people are paying the price. What are they doing? Are they criticizing God over here? Why would they not say something like this? You know what? Since it was completely unjustified that you created this world and we pay the price, we are not going to be mefashfesh b'maasav. We are not going to look and be very nice and somehow live up to what you want us to live up to. We are going to tell you one thing and right in your face. We are not going to do anything of that because you were completely incorrect in creating us in the first place. We just came to that decision. So what do you want by maasav, by you want to be mashmesh b'maasav? That means to say that after all, you do believe that there is some kind of reason for man to exist, and that is that he has to exist because he has to look after his deeds. All this seems to be incredibly paradoxical. Now, obviously, there are some people who would say like this. No, wait a moment. God definitely has good reasons to create man. Why? He wants to reward man. Let him live his life, and after 120 years, when he goes to the other world, in according to his deeds in this world, we will reward him or we will punish him. That's the normal traditional answer that you hear in the traditional community. There's only one problem about it. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And I'll tell you why. Because why does God need man to walk around in this world who have the option to be bad or to be good, so that on the end, after 120 years, they get or rewarded or they get punished? Why do you need the whole issue of punishment? Why do you need the whole issue of reward? If you are not having human beings, you neither have the problem of reward and punishment. People would probably say to me, but Rabbi Cardoso, you don't understand. Reward is a fantastic, great thing, and it would be such a pity if we would lose out on that. My answer to that is that neither makes any sense. You know why? Because if you would not be there, you would not miss not to be rewarded. You know, did 100 years ago anybody miss a computer? There was no computer, so you didn't miss it. It's only when you create it, then afterwards you start to miss it if you don't have one. So if you don't create man at all, and no, ein hochinami, as we say in Hebrew, and it is true that there is no reward, so there won't be any reward. And so, Baruch Hashem, there won't be any punishment at all, and there won't be all the other troubles. Why not? Because everything is completely and totally under control, purely by the very fact that there's nothing there. If God alone is there, and there's no universe, and there are no stars, and there are no all the other things there, and there are no human beings, and there is no suffering, everything is exactly the way as perhaps we would like to have it. The only thing is you won't be there and I won't be there. So what? Azma, we say in Hebrew. So what would be the big problem? What Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are discussing over here and why they take this particular vote is obviously something to make a point. They realize very well that you can't decide these matters on the basis of a majority vote. But they want, I think, to point to something. If man, after all, exists, although all the arguments are in favor for not having to him to exist, and still God decides to make this man to exist, then he must have a reason, to put it in human terms. There's only one problem about this, and that is that the reasons which God probably used when he decided against the majority vote of Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel, and that is, I think, what the story tries to tell us, is something which we cannot answer. And this is not an apologetics, what I'm saying over here. This is basic to the very nature of this world. Saying it a little different, do we have any clue of why God created the universe? Is there any information about that in the Torah or anywhere else? And there is only one clear-cut and honest answer. We do not have the slightest clue. The Torah starts with Bereshit bara Elokim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. There is no pasuk before that. Not another verse saying why he decided on doing that. That piece is completely absent. I always claim when I speak to my students that there's something missing in the Torah, and that is the whole answer. Why is there a need for anything? And the Torah is completely silent about it. What it says is this: now that the world has been created for reasons which we really do not know and are completely beyond us, now the only thing is that somehow there is some meaning to all this, which is reflected in this Torah by way of the stories and by way of the commandments which are found in there, where the Jews are being asked to live in according to these very commandments. That is where it starts to become real in the realistic and down-to-earth situation. We have to live in according to the mitzvot. But if you ask me the question, why do we need to live in according to the mitzvot, then the answer is, I have not the slightest clue. And do not make the mistake that what I'm trying to do is to get out of a problem. I just want to actually head on, have a clash with the problem, and understanding quite well what is doing over there. I ask you another question. If the issue of creation is a matter of yes or no man to exist, and that's all what there is to it, then why do we need the whole universe? We are an absolute spectacle in the universe. We make it as our business to see this as a major place, this world of ours, and how we live it, and so on. But if you look into the map of the universe, which is, by the way, all the time growing, and you ask the question, why does all that stuff need to exist? It has got absolutely nothing to do with you and me. We have no influence on it. Perhaps there is life out there. Could be, could not be. We don't know at this moment. I'm of the opinion that the best proof that there is life in the other planets is by the very fact that they never made contact with us. I hope you got it. But if there is a universe and we are a little thing there, this little globe of ours, and there is millions of stars, and also there was planets and also a lot of things, which in according to the Jewish belief and tradition, this was created by God, then it means that the issue of man in this world is only a little issue into the total picture of why God wanted to create this world. To say that afterwards God created this world and the universe for us is arrogance of the first order. Because we nearly don't play any role. We only play a role in this little place over here. Nothing more than that. But what it proves is that, therefore, there is something else going on which has got nothing to do with us, in which we do not play any role. And that is what Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel actually, I think, are trying to say over here. There is no need for man to exist. There is no need for man, or better, for the world and the universe to exist. But it does exist. And if it does exist and we believe in a God, then we say, obviously, we will have to say that there is meaning to that, but that meaning is something far beyond all that what we can ever imagine, because it goes into issues which are having a lot to do with the world, the universe, the stars, the planets out there, where there may or may not be some life, and probably most of the time there is no life there, and still God created all of it. If he created it, all of it, then I cannot, I hope you understand what I'm saying, I cannot decide on what the world is all about, or why God created this world, unless I would be able to explain not just why we are here, but also why the whole universe is there. And that is completely absent in our knowledge. It's not knowable. I emphasize once more, this is not a matter of apologetics. This is not a matter of saying, well, you know, since we don't have an answer, this is the kind of answer we are giving. No, this is basic to our very existence, to our very being here as human beings, to realize that there is very little going on as far as we understanding why at a certain moment, in a certain hour, God created, or better, decided on this creation, when for the same reason he could not have done so. By the way, I don't want to go into this now, and this would again touch on Spinoza, by the way, and that is the question about how can there be a God who needs to decide on something to do or not to do something, because if that is indeed the case, then it would be that as long as God has not yet created this world, he would be missing in perfection. And if he's missing in perfection, how can he be the perfect God? This is the question that Spinoza actually asks. Therefore, Spinoza, like Aristotle and others, are of the opinion that the universe always existed and there was never a beginning to it, there was never a creation, because a creation is only an indication that something was lacking. And there's a lot to be said about that, which I shall not go into now, next time for Torah emotion. But the fact is that all these issues are very closely related. So what can we say? What we can say is this. God decided to create this world. He decided to create man. If he would have asked our advice, we would have told him not to do so. But we are there. If God indeed, against our advice, decided to create man, then I must conclude from there that towards God, in God, whatever name you want to give it, there is a reason for it. Like there is a reason for all the stars and the moon and the sun and all the other planets to exist and all these billions of other things out there, of which most of it we haven't even touched yet and even seen yet. Science is not even started yet. But it has tremendous meaning. And what does the Jewish tradition say? Now that there is meaning which is not known to us, we are being created as part of that meaning. And if we are created part of that meaning, we play somewhere a role in this incredible thing, of which we do not really know what the original reasons were why that thing needs to be there. I know one thing, and that is that my life becomes meaningful because somehow I am playing a role in all this. Because if I would not be playing a role in all this, then I would not have been there. So there is meaning which is unknowable, which we can never put our finger on, but we know it is there. And what the Torah then afterwards does when it starts to speak about Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim et haaretz, and beginning did God create heaven and earth, in saying, also we don't give you any information why God decided on creating this very world and this universe and everything in it. We can tell you one thing, you play a role in all this, and that requires certain demands and certain commandments and certain moral issues, whatever it is, and you are asked to live up to it. So therefore the rabbi said, Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel says, Nimnu v'gamru. Once they had the discussion about the question about if it is good for man to be created or not to be created, instead of answering the question by saying, well, we majority have come to the conclusion that it is better for to be created, they answered very honestly and said, well, from our point of view, it would have been better not to be created because, you know, however beautiful life is, but on the other side, all the hardship which goes along with it may not be kedai, it may not be worthwhile to have this kind of a situation. But there's one problem. We are there. What now? What are we going to do now? Come the rabbis and say, well, now that you are there, never. You better start to live up to it. You better are memashmesh b'maasav. That you look after your deeds. But do we know why? We have no idea. This is humility, and it's very important to emphasize that from the very moment that we realize this. Now, I'm going to make the next step. If I do not know what the reason is why God created this world, then I can neither judge God on what he does right or what he does wrong. Because if I do not know why it is there, then when I start to judge God, I take certain criteria which I have created myself for what I think God should do, which does not at all fit with one principle, and that is the very fact that I do not know what it is why God does the things he does. Proof? He created a world of which I got not the slightest clue why it needs to be there. So God is therefore doing things which I will never understand, but there is a purpose, there is a meaning, there is a matara to it, as we say in Hebrew. It is definitely there, it is unknown to us, we are placed in all of this, and we are asked to be mimashmes v'maasav, to do the best and make the best out of it in our lives and even enjoy it. And God gives us a certain opportunity to do that up till a point. But when I'm going to ask the question, God, why do you need earthquakes? Why do you need an hurricane in America? Why do you need all the other terrible things? Then we are asking one and the same question, which I just asked before. Why do you need the world? Why do you need the universe? Why is there any need for anything to exist? Because the hurricane, the earthquake, or whatever else it may be, is obviously related to the reason why God created this world and the universe. But if I do not know what it is that he created or why he created that, it is unknown to me. So how can I judge if an earthquake does fit into this or does not fit into this? Because I don't even have the foundation to start working with. If a piece of knowledge, the most important part, why there is anything, is completely absent, and I cannot grasp it, then I cannot come afterwards to God and say, you should not have created an earthquake. Because the earthquake may quite well be part of the plan. Do you like that? No, by no means. But that has got nothing to do with this. Whether we like it or not is not the issue here. That's our point of view, and we are quite right about protesting against that, and that you often see within the Jewish tradition. But ultimately, it all depends on one thing. What is the reason why we are there? Once we would be able to say why there is a universe, then we would be able to say, okay, now that I know why there is a universe, I may decide on the question whether or not there is a why and a reason why there are earthquakes and why there are hurricanes and why there are all the other things. But as I long to have the foundational question or the foundational answer to why there is anything at all, I lack the criteria to decide if an earthquake is needed or not needed. I just don't know. I can only argue one thing. Somewhere it seems to be part of the plan. Do I like the plan? Under no circumstances. Is the plan fair? Under no circumstances. Fair from the perspective of God? I don't know. But definitely from the perspective of me. Now hear well what I'm saying. Therefore, any time when we try, and in the Jewish tradition also that happens, even in the Talmud that happens, we try to justify God for all the great misdeeds which he does. You know what we have done at that moment? What we are busy with? We are busy with idol worship. That's Avodah Zarah. Because what we are doing is, we basically are somehow taking certain criteria and projecting them on God, and say, God, you need to behave like that. Once we have done that, we have made him into an idol. Because we have put limitations on him, and we say, this is who you are. But my dear friends, we don't know who he is. We have got not the slightest clue. For the very good reason, we don't even know why he created this whole place. Why he created the universe. So we lack the knowledge. So how can I decide if the hurricane is justified or not justified? What I should not do is the following, and which is constantly done in religious circles, but it's very dangerous, that I will say the reasons why the hurricane happens is because man sinned. He did something wrong. Like we are also using that kind of an argument in the case of the Holocaust. I cannot deny that sometimes the Torah says that certain terrible things happen because man has sinned. But I can never make a rule out of that and say that in all cases where something goes wrong in this world is always because we did something wrong. No, it may not at all have anything to do with that. It may have to do with the very plan of why there is a world, why there is existence. Just like existence is actually unfair and unjustified, so an earthquake is unjustified. So everything else is unjustified, which creates some kind of pain. So I'm saying like this, any attempt made by philosophers, including Jewish philosophers, who say, you know, we must justify God for what he does, and they go out of their way to do that, you are already busy with idol worship. That's no longer speaking about God. Because God is a person, is a personality, being, whatever name is, which has his own reasons, which are not at all depending on human criteria of what we think it should be. That we are having a notion like that, including myself, that we very much would like him to be like that, so that he fits into what we think is good and what is bad. And we are, as human beings, obviously doing that. And you find in the prophets that constantly they protest against God for this and said, why did you do this and why did you do that? And we, from our perspective, are absolutely right in making, asking that question. But the moment we start to try to justify the answer and say, well, this is the reason why or that is the reason why, we are actually busy making God into an idol. It's not my business. That's, by the way, what Pharaoh did, the king of Egypt did, when he started to complain about the very fact that, he wanted the Nile, says the Midrash, to do exactly what it wanted to do. He was the god of the Nile, so the Nile had to give water, and the Pharaoh decided on what that Nile should be doing, what that god should be doing by giving water to the people of Egypt. But that is idol worship. And therefore, the whole question of what is called in English, in the philosophical world, it is called theodicy. Theodicy means to say the justification for God, to somehow plead him non-guilty, is idol worship. I hope you got that point. It's very, very important to keep this in mind. So therefore I'm saying, is God righteous? The answer is, no, he is not righteous. He's neither non-righteous. He's somewhere else. All these particular words don't fit to him at all. Because we don't know what the criteria are and the foundations are on which he built this world and why he built that world. I only know once more, very important to remember, there's tremendous meaning to this. I just have not the slightest clue what that meaning is. That's hard and difficult to live with, but that's what it is. I cannot say to God, or I can say to God, why did you create an earthquake? But I remind you what Eof was told. Job, when he was so terribly, terribly ill, and he lost all his children, the famous book of Job, of Eof, where God says to him after he starts to complain, and he says a very clear, straightforward word to Eof, where were you when I started to lay the foundations of this world? You were not there. So you don't know why I created this place. So how can you ask me these kind of questions? I permit you to ask it from a human perspective. I fairly well understand. But if you want to speak as a philosopher, then there's absolutely nothing to answer there. Because my brain, my mind, whatever it is somewhere totally else, somewhere else at all. I had a reason, but that reason I can never put in human terminology, because then you would be God. And since you are not God, you will not know. Avodah Zarah, even to try to justify God. And therefore, it is also very dangerous to start to get into situations which some people have done, including in the religious community, as I said before, to try to explain why the Holocaust happened or why other terrible things happened. Mission impossible. It is dangerous, because what you are doing is you are judging other people. Our grandparents in Poland did not live up to the laws of the Torah, and therefore they got the Holocaust. You're going to explain 2 million children being killed that way? And so many tzaddikim, so many righteous people like that? Is it not more honest to say, we just don't know? True, it is true that anything what happens in this world we should try to learn from a purely subjective point of view. If I can learn from the Holocaust to be a better Jew, I should definitely do that. But to say that the Holocaust happened because the Jews didn't behave, that's Abu Dazara. That's idol worship. And there's a lot of idol worship around in the Orthodox community, I can tell you that. Now, let's move now to the second part of this story. What we have to say is this. From our perspectives, there are flaws in the creation. What is the main flaw? That the creation is there. It better would have been if it would not be there at all. Once we decide on that God is not as nice as we would like him to be, to fit into what we think is nice, then we have also to realize that we have to apply the same rules concerning the laws in the Torah. Just like there's an earthquake, there are some earthquake-like laws in the Torah. For example, the case of the Mamzer. Is this fair? No. Is an earthquake fair? No. But is an earthquake not created by God? Yes. So why can't the law of the Mamzer not also be created by God? In principle, it could be. And there are a few more laws like that. Do I like these laws? Do I agree with these laws? No, I don't like them as much as I don't like an earthquake. But if I have not the slightest clue of why there is anything at all, and what is included in that, if I have no clue at all about that, then how can I say that because I don't like a law in the Torah, that therefore this law is not given by God? These are two totally different issues. I hope you understand what I'm trying to get to. What I'm saying is, there are laws in the Torah, they are completely unjustified. I don't like them. And the rabbis, no doubt, and kol hakavod to them, as we say in Hebrew, they tried everything and anything to fight these laws. I come back to this in a moment. They tried to find ways out of the Mamzer problem by proving that this woman was not really married in the first marriage, and therefore the second marriage was not invalid, and therefore the child is not a Mamzer. And we are doing that, all sort of things. Look in the Talmud, you will find all sort of different ways where the rabbis went out of their way. Sometimes you wonder if they didn't go too far out of their way, because they were somewhere undermining some of these laws. But they did. They had the incredible chutzpah and courage to do this. But there was a certain moment when they said, till there. Beyond that we can't go. Why not? Because ultimately we do not know anything. So how can we say that the whole Mamzer law is out of the way? We should throw it out of the window? I can neither throw the earthquake out of the window. These are realities. What I can do is to find ways, as much as I tried to fight earthquakes, by building better buildings, by creating all sorts of constructions which make the earthquake not have an effect, I'm doing the same thing with the law of the Mamzer. I will create all sorts of halachic things around it, so that in most of the time it doesn't damage too much. But I can't always stop every earthquake. I can't stop every hurricane. I cannot stop some of the laws of the Torah to be very painful. But this has nothing to do with the question whether or not God has created these laws. It is just a matter that I don't like it. And a moment when I would say, God, you should not have given that law, or I do away with that law, I'm actually saying, we do away with the earthquake. Because ultimately, they are one and the same. Now, let me teach you something else and tell you something else. These issues you already see in Tanakh itself all the time. I suppose you've all heard about Søren Kierkegaard, the great Danish Christian philosopher. A most remarkable man who was the father of religious existentialism. He wrote a book which is very worthwhile reading about the Akedat Yitzchak, about the sacrifice of Isaac. One of his most important works, a little booklet, but there he lays down in Christian terminology the great concepts of God in relationship to man. You know, people like Christopher, what is his name again? Christopher Hitchens, yeah, and a few more people have been writing about it, and they have not the slightest clue what they're writing about, to be quite honest. These are foolish books, because they have no insight into the whole way how religion works. And they're making all sorts of superficial statements, and they sell millions of these books because people like to read this kind of stuff, and it's not even serious at all. Kierkegaard was a serious thinker. Kierkegaard asked the question, why did God go and challenge Abraham? What was the purpose behind that? Is this fair? The child is going to be sacrificed on an altar because the man, the father, needs to prove to his God that he loves him so much, and the child pays the price. I remind you of the mamzers, nearly the same thing. Sacrifice. And Kierkegaard says an important thing. Although he doesn't say what I just told you before, but I think he's touching on that. He's saying like this, there are moments in history here, well, and I hope you remember this, where there is a need for the suspension of morality, of the ethical. That's the way how he calls it. The suspension of the ethical. You suspend a certain moral principle which normally you keep to. Why? Because other goals need to be achieved, which you cannot get if you do not suspend that particular rule, that ethical rule at that moment. And one of the examples of that is the case of Akedat Yitzchak. Objectively, God is absolutely not righteous when he asks Abraham to do something like that. Was it necessary from within the meaning of existence? The answer is yes. But it did require the suspension of the moral for just a moment. That's the point which Kierkegaard in his typical Christian way makes. And by the way, you find this in Hasidic stuff as well, where they discuss these matters. And they come very close to Kierkegaard, very interesting. The suspension of the ethical. So if there is indeed such a thing that sometimes, because God had certain things in mind when he created this world, or better, why he created this world, and this needs to be achieved, and it requires at a certain moment the suspension of the ethical, then that is necessary. Why? Because a certain thing needs to be achieved, which we do not know what it is. And the very fact that we can more or less prove that Kierkegaard is right is for the following reason. If there's a universe with millions of stars and planets and everything else, what has this to do with morality? Do we need the universe for reasons of morality? It's got nothing to do with it. But the universe is there. Which means to say there is more to this world than just morality and ethics. You can't bring everything down on the question if it is justified by criteria of justice. Because there is a world out there which is much larger than anything we have over here in this little planet of ours, which has got nothing to do with anything ethical. But it's still there. Which proves the point that there are reasons for God to create the world and the universe, which indeed has nowhere any connection with the moral issue whatsoever. If we want to bring it all back to morality, we're having a big problem, because for morality, I don't need the Jupiter and I don't need all the other stars and all the other planets out there. So it proves one point. The story is very different. It proves that there is a much larger issue going on, far beyond anything we can understand. And, like Kierkegaard says, it sometimes requires that what is to us ethical needs to be moved aside for another prime reason which is only known to God, and therefore things happen in this world we don't like, and there are commandments in the Torah which we don't like. And now you understand the title of my lecture. God is not righteous and the Torah is not moral. These are true statements. We have to realize that. We have obviously a problem which I still need to deal with. Don't we always speak about God as the good God? as the righteous God? Is this not full within the Bible itself and in the Jewish tradition? No doubt it is, and we have to understand then how that works, because we have now created the problem in these situations. By the way, I want to tell you something else. The rabbis were very well aware of this problem. They realized what was going on. And that is reflected already in the story of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai about the question if man should be created or not be created. But in many other ways as well. I give you a very remarkable example of this. I don't have to tell you, I can speak hours about this. But we'll have to keep it somewhere limited. There is a midrash. Hear this following midrash. I dare to say that you will not find anything like that in any other religion, any other tradition. The midrash asks the question, who was at fault at the time when Adam ate from the apple? Who is really responsible for this? So the story seems to say, well, Eve gave the apple to Adam and he ate it, and they're both responsible. Perhaps the woman is more responsible, perhaps the man is more responsible. We shall not go into this now. Comes the midrash and throws in something which is really quite incredible. The midrash actually says, it is totally unfair to have been man being somehow responsible for eating from the tree. Because what did the tree do? If they would eat from it, they would become mortal. Man would die. So we say man brought himself mortality in the world by eating from the apple, or whatever it was. And according to the Talmud, it may have been an etrog, maybe also the other things. We shall not go into this now. But the midrash continues and says, this is unfair. You know why? Because God had already decided that man would be mortal. That was already out there long before he created man. Man is by definition a mortal being. So now you tell afterwards, you say to Adam, why did you eat from the apple and by that you made yourself mortal? Then Adam obviously says, God, you already had decided that I would be mortal. So why do you hold me responsible for this? Hear this. Hear the fine way in which the rabbis in their critical observations made the point. They said you can compare this to the following case. A man writes a get to his wife, a bill of divorce to his wife. And he puts it in his pocket and he walks in to the house where his wife is. And he says to his wife, give me a cup of tea. She brings him a cup of tea and he drinks it and he finds out that it's lukewarm. And he says to his wife, it is lukewarm, here is your get. Here is your get. Says the woman back to her, what do you say? You're saying that because I gave you a lukewarm cup of coffee or tea, that's the reason why you wrote the get? You gave me a get, but you wrote a get long before you gave, I gave you the cup of coffee. So what caused what? Says the midrash, this is the same thing what God said to man. Hear this, this is unbelievable, but this is really critique on God. God, what do you say? You come to us and say that we are responsible for the fact that we are mortal? You already have decided a long time ago that we were mortal, so don't hold me responsible. And then afterwards there are a few more cases when Yosef has the whole problem with his brothers and ultimately they get into Egypt, as you all know the story. Then the question also is, who is really responsible there? And then when you look very carefully in the Torah, you will see that God decided hundreds of years before the whole story with Joseph and his brothers that the Jews were going to go down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt. So they've got nothing to do with it. So what the Midrash is trying to indeed show is the incredible paradox in all of this. We hold man responsible, but he's not responsible. They were very well aware that these things are not straightforward and that there is some kind of mystery behind all this. Which is exactly the mystery I just spoke about before. To come back to the Mamzer law. There's a midrash about the Mamzer law, which I will read you out, which is also in itself remarkable. Who is responsible for the Mamzer law? Hear this. Comes the midrash and says like this. There is a pasuk in the Torah, in Tanakh, in the Bible, which says, behold the tears of the oppressed. Ask the Talmud or the Midrash, who are the oppressed? Answers the Talmud, the oppressed people meant here are the Mamzerim. are those children who are born from a relationship which is forbidden. How did the child sin that he should get punished for that? And why does it concern him? You hear the rabbis themselves saying these very things. And then they say the following, which is really remarkable. The Pasuk continues and says, those who are oppressed, they have no comforter. Nobody is comforting them. But they are in the hands of the oppressors. Ask the Talmud, who are the oppressors of the Mamzerim? And they do not have any comforter? Answers the Talmud, or better the Midrash, the Sanhedrin. The court of Jewish law, the highest court of Jewish law, they decided and said that this child is a mamzer. And therefore they are oppressed, this is the word, oppressed by the Sanhedrin. And here comes God and says, you know what? I am their comforter. Because I will one day take away from them the status of mamzerut. Hey, wait a moment. Who introduced the word of the mamzer? The Sanhedrin or God? The answer is God. So here God is playing the big thing. I'm the great good fellow, you know. I'm very merciful on them. And I give the whole thing and the responsibility lies with the Sanhedrin. No, it relies with you, God. You created that. So again, the Jewish tradition here is trying to make the point, God does things which are completely unjustified from our point of view. But again, once more, as long as we do not know what the whole story is about this universe of ours, we cannot really say that therefore it should not be. It needs to be, but it's unfair. Perhaps it is even immoral. Now, do not misunderstand me. I'm not saying that therefore Jewish law can do whatever it likes to do, and when it does something wrong, you can always say, well, we don't know because God has his reasons. No, what you find so beautifully within the Jewish tradition, I already indicated before, is this. He says, or better, the Jewish tradition says, anywhere where there is any chance to fight these laws, which are unfair in the Torah, by limiting them, like in the case of the mamzer or the aguna, whatever it is, we find a way out that the women are not agunot and the mamzer is not really a mamzer. We are obligated as the court of Israel and as the rabbis of Israel to do everything about it. And after we have fought God left and right on this and we lost the ultimate victory, then we stand with our head, with our back against the wall and we say, now we can't do anything anymore. But there's never such a thing in the Jewish tradition that say, well, you know, God wills is like that, and therefore that's all what there is to it. No, we fight God. And now I'm going to say a very dangerous thing, and don't tell Rabbi Jay, and don't tell anybody else. And that is this. I believe, and I need much more time to explain this, that part of the function of halacha is to undo the injustice of God. That halacha is there, which we need to apply and say, we will not go along with this law in the Torah. There are limits, how far you can go there. And it depends on how the Jewish tradition is structured and how it works. But sometimes the halacha is the fighting force against the will of God, as if God is saying to us, I'm going to create some damage, and you are going to be the one who is going to solve the damage which I created. Now, what I just said is dangerous stuff. But I believe it is true that this is the way how the Jewish tradition works. God versus God. God fighting himself. God saying to us, use the halacha against me to settle certain things and to work certain things out, which I would not do unless you fight for it. Like Abraham says to God yesterday in the parasha, why are you wanting to destroy the town of Sodom and Gomorrah? Here is what we call in Hebrew the shakla betaria. The concept of going and coming, the struggling with God. God, you can't do this. God, obviously, there's an answer. If I decide that I want to do this, then I have my reasons why. But man is obligated to fight God and say to God, from our perspective, you can't do anything like that. And therefore, what's about 40 tzaddikim, 30 righteous people, 20 righteous people in the town of Sodom? And instead of God saying, wait a moment, I'm the authority. I will decide on these matters. God does not say anything at all. What is more than that, God seems to be greatly joyful about the fact that Avram fights him. Because he says, ah, now I understand why it is. Or now I have this man in the right place. Because while I have my reasons, he has his reasons. And these reasons are nearly as important as mine are. And therefore I want him to fight me wherever I can. Sometimes the halakha is a fighting process against the damage which God sometimes does to this world, probably because he wants us to rectify certain things and therefore needs to know that there are some people out there who are prepared to do that. Hard and difficult words. One more word and then we will have to finish. So what is left of the good God? More than that, is it not true that the Torah tells us at the very beginning that we were created in God's image? And if we are created in God's image, then we will have to say, well, so great that image isn't. So why should we actually go and live as if we are created in the image of God? The answer is here is this, and this is a long talk in itself. But what it comes down to is this. We are only partially created in the image of God. This is not a one way which goes to the very end. Because God says to us also, there are moments when you don't need to be my image. When it comes to ethical issues, what I implanted in your heart, and what most of the time I also apply into this world and try to do as good as I can, that is where I want you to be living in my image. And that is where I am good. But my good is limited. In, and now I say a very important philosophical work, which is not so easy to translate. Within himself, God is totally good. That is to say, as far as God needs to answer himself of why he does the things he does, and why it therefore is that he created this universe and this world and man, which from our perspective it could have been better if he would not have been there, then God has his reasons and therefore is good. Klapei, we say in Hebrew, himself. He's only good towards himself. He has got only to give responsibility to himself. You know also why that is? Because there's really nobody else to give responsibility to when it comes to the ultimate meaning of God. Because compared to him, we are not even there. You say every day in the prayer book, if you remind yourself of it, in Shachrit, Mincha, and Arvit, we say the last word on Aleinu L'Shabeach. What do we say on the end? Ein ot milevado. There's nobody but him. It somehow implies the following thing, that there is nothing else but him, and we are all in him, whatever that means. And I shall not go into this now. All what I wanted to say is this. God is indeed good up till a point. We are asked to live in his image up till a point as far as it relates to ethics. But when it comes to the point where God needs to achieve certain goals which are beyond that, where there is the suspension of the ethical, there we are not asked to be like God. We are not God. We, our important, let's say, responsibility in the world is to be as good as we can be. But we can never be good in the sense of God being good purely because there are certain sides to God which for him are good. And from our perspective, they are definitely not good. And therefore, again, my title, God is not as righteous and the Torah is not as moral. But that is no reason to say that therefore God does not exist, like Hitchens would have it, and others would like to have it, or even Spinoza would like to have it. Or for that reason to say, because of the very fact that we don't like the law of the Mamzer, of the Aguna, therefore we should just do away with it. That's a complete false way of thinking. I'm only saying one thing. Any trial, any way in which we try to justify God is ultimately idol worship. And that is an important point to keep in mind whenever we speak about God, because we are doing this right and left the whole day, especially religious people who have this feeling that they need to defend God. That's not our task. Our task is to live in according to the Torah and according to morality as far as the Torah requires that from us. And that's it. Like I said before in the panel, there are some problems which we better leave to God. We don't need to solve his problems. We need to solve our own problems. Thank you very much. I don't mind to give one or two answers to some questions. So I don't know if you want to, but I'm obviously open to that. Wait a moment, I have a few questions here.
I have a question. A mamzer cannot marry another Jew, but suppose a male mamzer marries a Gentile woman. Their children, I'm guessing, would not be mamzerim?
Yes, this is only between two Jewish partners.
And if those children
between three Jewish partners.
If those children later decide to become Jewish, would they be still free of that schisma?
Yes, they can definitely become Jewish.
And then the other, to follow that up, what about a female mamzer or a aguna? They are marrying a Gentile.
They cannot marry a Gentile.
Pardon?
It's a mixed marriage. They are not allowed to marry a Gentile unless the Gentile becomes Jewish.
Well, if they did it, I mean, civilly, and then I'm thinking of their children. Would their children then be able to...
If the mother is Jewish, then the child is Jewish.
Okay.
Doesn't matter if it is a Jewish father or a non-Jewish father.
And the aguna also... children.
The aguna, if she would get married or she would have a relation with somebody while she is officially still married to her first husband, because we don't know what it is, then her child is a mamzer.
So, but the remedy does apply to a male mamzer then?
Pardon?
The remedy does apply to a male mamzer and his children, in that if he married a Gentile woman...
The child will not be a mamzer.
And the children then could convert to Judaism, right?
Yes, they can.
Okay.
Yes.
I have many, many questions, but I just maybe ask you one simple one. How do you know that there's a plan except for the fact that you want there to be a plan?
I don't know. I only can say that within the Jewish tradition, there is a claim that God has a plan. Objectively, I don't know.
But all the evidence that you suggests there's no plan because it makes no sense and we can't make sense of it. So it's a tautology. By definition, there's not a plan. It's just... called just an unknown.
It is an unknown thing, right? Absolutely true. But I say once more, you are right from a philosophical perspective, your question is perfect. From the Jewish traditional perspective, there is this issue that it constantly claims that there is a reason why God created the world. And that reason, therefore, is what God is trying to achieve, and everything else has to fit into that. And that particular thing, what needs to be achieved, may not be to our liking.
Right, but the arguments lead to Spinoza rather than to the Jewish
tradition.
Absolutely. Position.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Thank you.
If we can't know why God created the universe, if we accept that premise, can we know how much God is involved in day-to-day life?
Oh. That is really... an issue which was discussed by Jewish philosophers hundreds of years ago, where some of them seem to have said that they had doubts how much God has been involved in this world. Over the years, and what became officially traditional Judaism, we would say today, that he all the time is. But I have to admit that if you look in earlier Jewish philosophers, there were some who said that they were not so sure about it. And by the way, one of them was Maimonides himself. But this is a very difficult topic. Yeah. The question about what is called in Hebrew Hashkachat HaPeratit, divine providence. Is there really all the time a divine providence, or is there not? And this is open to debate within the Jewish tradition. Today we have closed that debate, because now everybody will tell you, sure, God is everywhere and anywhere at all time, and he's always busy with everything. But earlier authorities were not so sure about that. Which once more proves my point, what I said in the morning, it is open to debate.
If we can't understand you said we can't. It's idolatry to try and interpret the Holocaust. So therefore, it can't have any meaning for us because we can't understand it. So what's the point?
The point is only one thing. I know there is meaning, and the meaning is unknown to me.
So if the meaning is unknown, it doesn't have meaning. It's the same thing.
I'm not sure. It could be that you're right. I'm not sure if you're not playing
around
with words.
If I spoke to you now in Chinese.
I know for sure.
But you know, wait. Sure. If I spoke to you in Chinese now, you know I have some meaning. You can't understand it, so there's no point in me saying it. In other words, God is speaking to us, but we can't know what he means. What's the point?
I don't think that that is the same thing. Here it is a matter that somebody tells you that there is definitely meaning to your life, but it is beyond you to understand what it is, and therefore you can still accept that there is meaning without knowing what that meaning is.
So I accept the Holocaust as meaning, but I also have to accept that I can't possibly understand it. So then God caused something that I can't possibly understand. What's the point?
The point is with God, not with me. For me, it has no point.
But it's a human event. So a human event is there for us to understand, but we can't understand it, so it's pointless.
I'm not so sure you're right about the first part that you said, right. and that has to have meaning for us. I'm not so sure that's true.
If it has no meaning, it means nothing.
It means nothing from that point of view, you're right. But I would not say that therefore, because I know that is something that is meaningful. My parents may have me to do something which I don't understand what its meaning
but
is.
But eventually you will understand it.
I'm not so sure if that's always true.
Then there's no meaning in it.
That depends a little bit on what you mean by the word meaning. I hear your point. Any other questions? Okay, hope to see you next time again. That's Gott Hashem.